This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
The pleasure is all mine. We were just chatting a moment ago before I pressed record about why I do like living in Africa and the chaos and the decentralization that comes with being on the African continent. And I invited you to come and stay with me. And then you said, you can't leave the UK. Why is that?
Well, I mean, in order for me to leave the UK, I'd have to renew my passport. And that means that I'd have to get a digital ID compliant passport. And that's not something that I'm prepared to do. So, unfortunately, that means that I can't leave the UK because, and I think this is an important point to discuss as well, that, you know, there's been obviously the UK government has recently purportedly said it wants to bring in a UK digital ID called the Brit Card, and that's caused, a lot of political upheaval, and there's a lot of opposition against it amongst the public. And people are saying that they're not going to comply. They're not going to go along with the rollout, the proposed or supposed rollout of this Brit Card. But unfortunately, the system that is in place already is through something called the Digital Trust Framework, which is sets a set of technical standards for what are called interoperable digital ID products. So one of those products is undoubtedly the British issued passport, which is a biometric digital ID. And the whole point of digital ID, contrary to the impression that's been given by Keir Starmer and his government with the proposed rollout of the Brit Card, is that it's not reliant upon one single app or one single card. It is the whole system that they've been developing for, at this point, more than a decade, is reliant upon interoperable digital ID, what they call vendor-agnostic products. So these is things like your driving licence, your passport, your bank cards, your store cards, your utility bill payment cards, everything that you use. The point of interoperability is to make the data from those individual disparate products available in a machine-readable, exchangeable format that fits within this thing called the Digital Trust Framework, the Digital Assets and Trust Framework. That is how digital ID has long been intended to operate, not only in the UK, but globally. This is a global system, and the Brit Card, in my view, is a distraction because it focuses people's attention on what the promoted image of digital ID is. Certainly that's what the UK government want people to think digital ID is. That is not what digital ID is. It's not how digital ID is designed to operate. And really, the Brit Card, well, it doesn't exist, actually, the Brit Card. It's not gone out for market consultation. It's not gone out for public consultation. It's not part of the approved digital assets, digital ID assets that the government have got. Brit Card's not on it. So Brit Card doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. So it is a pure PR stunt, and the only question really is why are they doing this?
Well, before we talk about why, let's talk about what. When we talk about digital ID, and what are we talking about?
We're talking about the linchpin for a global system of behavioral control. It stems from Sustainable Development Goal 16.9, and that says that the objective is to provide legal identity to everybody on Earth. It doesn't say anything about digital ID, it just says legal identity. But prior to SDG 16.9 being launched in 2016, ID 2020, which brings together groups like Ademia and Accenture and Microsoft and groups like that, had already started looking at fulfilling that particular SDG. They were tasked as the kind of UN-approved global body, if you like, to oversee the rollout of global digital identity. And they firmly and openly state that that the SDG 16.9 compliant identity is means digital identity. That's what it means, digital ID. So digital ID is designed to be biometric, i.e. it has some sort of facial recognition, like an image of your face, some sort of biological identifier. It could be iris scans or fingerprints or your face. Commonly it's your face. So in the UK, nearly all of us have got biometric digital ID driving licenses. Those driving licenses have got our face on it. That face is a machine readable digital, you know, that can be turned into machine readable data. And, you know, that's our biometric identifier in the case of that particular driving license. It also has what it calls assets attached to it. So a digital ID asset is a piece of information. So your home address is an asset. Your the amount of welfare benefits you may have received is formed as another asset. Your name is an asset. Your age, attributes. They're all attributes. That all of these attributes come together to form your digital ID. And the system that is designed to do that, to create your EID or your electronic or your digital ID, is an interoperable system. So you might have your name, your driving license number and your address on your driving license, but you don't have that on your bank card. Your bank card doesn't have your name and address on it. It's just got your bank details, which is in a chip on the bank card. Well, currently, the driving license system, which is run by the DVLA in the UK, and the bank card, which is run by your card provider or your bank, your private bank, they're separate systems. They're not linked. You know, the data from your driving license, even though you might have used your driving license to open the bank account, it's not linked to your purchases with your card. I mean, it's easy enough to put the two together, and that's obviously what the police, when they're investigating something, or the intelligence agencies, or whoever is looking at this, can do that. But currently, those are two separate systems that they need to interrogate individually and bring the data together. The whole point of interoperability and the linchpin that brings all that together is digital ID, is to make the data from the card and from the driving license exchangeable in a unified, standardized, machine-readable format. So then the data from everything you do. So, you know, if you're caught on an MPR camera, AMPR camera, driving along the motorway, that can be linked directly to your driving license, which can then be linked to anything that you've spent in the service station on the way up the motorway instantly. That is the point of digital ID, to bring all these systems together into one, what, you know, the Bank for International Settlements call a unified database. So a unified ledger, which will probably be some sort of distributed ledger technology, probably blockchain. But that's the idea. So you bring data from every source, that everything that is connected to your life can be made interoperable on the back end by these systems that they've already erected. And in the UK, that's called the Digital Trust Asset Framework.
I mean, I was late to the party, but I remember talking about this in late 2020, early 2021, and people laughed it off and were very quickly dismissed the whole thing as a conspiracy theory. Well, obviously it isn't. And it's now suddenly being proposed everywhere.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely a global policy initiative. I mean, one of the things that I've recently written a piece on my Substack where I stress that point. You know, this is not wherever you live, whether you live in South Africa, the UK, the US, Brazil, wherever, China, wherever, the drive towards universal digital ID is a global governance policy initiative. It's got nothing to do with your government. I mean, the governments are involved in the development and the rollout of those policy initiatives. You know,
but they're just middle management.
They are middle management. Yeah. They're not leading it. I mean, and if you look also, I mean, if you look at the history of, for example, the United Nations, which is where all this sustainable development goal stuff comes from, you know, it's very much was an oligarch led project. The Rockefeller Foundation, pretty much, and the Rockefeller Foundation and their partners, people like the Carnegies, put the UN together. It's their baby. They put it together, and ever since then, in 1998, we had Kofi Annan just say that there'd been a quiet revolution at the heart of the United Nations, and it was no longer considered itself an intergovernmental organisation, but rather an organisation that's existence was to promote policies that were beneficial for business and that worked with, you know, policy initiatives for the benefit of the business community. You know, and therefore it's not surprising that despite the fact that when the UN announced SDG 16.9, it made no official announcement about digital ID, it just called it legal identity. Now we've got to the stage where in 2023 the UN is openly stating that it means digital ID and it wants to link that to all financial activity. So the UN's quite open about that now.
The whole thing's a bait and switch though, isn't it? Because I mean, Starmer, he said that it's about immigration, which is obviously absurd.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's absolutely preposterous to make that argument. It's a redundant argument, and it is almost impossible to imagine that, you know, the government are stupid enough to make it. Illegal immigration to the UK is not going to be deterred one iota by digital ID, because the people that come to the UK illegally know that they're coming to the UK illegally. Now, Starmer's kind of hook for, or PR selling point, supposedly, for pushing the Brit card, is that you won't be able to work in the UK without one. But you can't work...
Yeah, I mean, he literally said that.
Yeah. He's literally said that it's a precondition of employment in the UK. Now, the national insurance number that every British citizen has once they're 16... that is also a precondition of employment in the UK. You cannot get paid legally in the UK unless you've got a national insurance number. And every employer is required by law to ensure that they get your national insurance number. So the idea that a digital ID will make any difference to that system is ridiculous. Because the people that exploit slave labour in the UK... don't ask the people that they're slave labourers if they have national insurance numbers, because they know full well that they won't have them, just as they won't ask them if they've got a Brit card, because they won't have that either. So it doesn't make any difference to illegal slave labour and exploitation, economic exploitation in the UK. It makes absolutely no difference whatsoever. Nor does it make any difference to the traffickers. Because the traffickers, it's a multi-billion dollar global industry. The traffickers know that they are, the people that they are smuggling into the country are by definition illegally being trafficked, because if it wasn't illegal, they wouldn't have a market. Their whole market is based upon the concept of it being illegal. So they don't care about laws. By definition, an illegal trafficker doesn't care about laws supposed to deter them.
Yes. He's not going to suddenly go, okay, let me get a digital ID so I can enter legally.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean the only thing about the digital ID that, you know, that traffickers might think about, you know, could be beneficial for them is that if it, you know, potentially if I mean, it's the whole thing is just preposterous. So potentially if, you know, currently I think 2.8 million people have supposedly signed a petition opposing, which is enormous for a petition in the UK. I mean, they normally, the government website that runs these petitions, normally they're lucky if they get a couple of 100,000 people signing the petition. Supposedly, this one's got now nearly more than 2.8 million. It got something like 2 million in the first day. So, clearly...
Yeah. That doesn't sound organic.
No. I am highly suspicious of that. I'm highly suspicious of the whole thing, to be honest. I don't think it's legitimate. For a start, as I just said earlier, the brick card doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a brick card. It doesn't exist.
Ian, I'm wondering now if we are falling into that category of being a Luddite. I remember in the 90s when the internet came about and cell phones came about and people were pushing back and saying, you know, this is the mark of the beast, etc. We gotta resist. And obviously, we are now. This does seem inevitable. And I'm just wondering, just as a thought experiment, if this were our future, is there a way in which we can exist with it that perhaps is better? In other words, I don't know, if digital ID is perhaps privatized or in a perhaps more decentralized, but again, it can't be decentralized because the very nature of it is centralized. But I think you kind of get what I'm asking. Like, is there a way to exist with it that's maybe better than what you're talking about?
Well, ironically, we don't need digital ID by virtue of the fact of the technology that already exists. You know, distributed ledger technology, if it operates on what it's called a permissionless basis, i.e. you don't need permission to access the network. So if that's, let's use the example of blockchain. So Bitcoin, for example, is based upon a permissionless blockchain. So you and I, you live in South Africa, or I live in the UK, I could buy, you know, one of your books or a t-shirt or a video or something like that from you in the UK. You don't need to know who I am, and I don't need to know who you are. We could conduct a transaction, and the system itself, because it's a permissionless blockchain ledger with cryptographic encryption at either end of that transaction, would guarantee the safety of that transaction. So you and I could buy from each other with confidence. So there, you know, there are things like delivery versus payment, smart contracts that you could put on that where the money's not released until I get the product. But we don't need to identify each other ourselves. The system itself guarantees the potential viability of the transaction. Now, were we going down that route with that potential use of distributed ledger technology, as in it being what you've just said, a decentralized, permissionless access system, then sure, there's loads of stuff that we could do. We don't, you know, I mean, for example, driving licenses, for example, you wouldn't necessarily need one. You could have an app that just proves that you've got a driving license token on the blockchain, and you wouldn't have to divulge your personal information about your name, your address, you wouldn't need to do that because you would just need to apply for it and then get the authorized token, which could be anonymous, proving that you've got a driving license. So there are lots. The problem we have with technology, and the reason that people like you and I that question it, I think, get called Luddites, is because by opposing the centralized control of technology, you're, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you're arguing against the inevitability of the use of the technology. No, it's not about the potential benefits or pitfalls of technology itself. It's about the way that technology is intended to be used by those that control it. And those that control it, who for example, control the investment in, at the moment, let's say, Bitcoin, which is, you know, increasingly coming under the financial control of groups like BlackRock, their objectives are control. They want to erect a controlled, a behavioural control system. But that very same technology doesn't have to be used in that way. So, yeah, I mean, there's every reason to hope that we could enjoy the benefits of, you know, the quote-unquote technological transformation or technological revolution without all the accompanying behavioural controls that come with it. And I think that's the key point. It's a system. What they're trying to use technology for is to erect a system of behavioural control. And we don't have to have that. And it, ironically, the technology itself, the basis of the technology itself, DLT technology and fintech to a great financial technology to a great extent, means that we don't need any of that. We don't, you know, the control layer is added on top unnecessarily.
Without getting into a discussion about Elon, or we can, but he made an interesting comment a couple of years ago, which I haven't forgotten. It was about AI. And he said, well, AI is inevitable. So the way to stop a monopolization of AI is basically to enter the market and create competition. I think that's maybe a variation of what I was perhaps asking. If digital ID and all this technological progress is unstoppable, then perhaps creating a market of competition might be one way to I don't know, lower the stakes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think digital ID and AI, and I would question what Elon Musk says about AI in terms of its capability. I mean, Elon Musk is part of a group of technocrats that are very close to the Trump administration, who insist that AI is inevitably going to be sentient, that it's going to be some sort of, you know, like omnipresent God, you know, and that it will, you know, revolutionize human history, and we'll have to meld with technology to be able to cope with the singularity, the moment when technology outstrips our ability to keep up with it, you know, and it becomes self-perpetuating. So all of that is highly speculative, and at the current moment,
it's fear porn.
Yeah, it's fear porn. And at the moment, looking at development of AI, we are some way off from superintelligent AI. You know, we haven't yet developed theory of mind AI, which would be the next step, and even that looks extremely hypothetical. One of the great ironies is that there are people like Musk going around insisting that AI can be conscious when we, as yet, as a species, haven't grasped and don't understand what consciousness is. So quite how you manage to program a machine with something you haven't got a clue what your objective is, is remarkable. And clearly,
yeah, how do you engineer something? Yeah, how do you engineer something that you don't know what it is?
Yeah, you don't know what it is. So I mean, it's just silly. All of this stuff is very silly. But it is, you know, that going back to the Luddite thing, is AI useful? Yeah, of course it's useful. There's loads of stuff you could do with AI. For example, if you look at the I think it's called the National federal data set, or I can't remember, sorry, it escapes me. But it's the Palantir's NHS data set that it's got for the National Health Service in the UK. So it's trying to bring together, you know, the NHS is huge in the UK, so it's trying to bring together all its systems into one manageable, unified ledger where all data can be manipulated and extracted and managed in one place. Now, if the purpose of that was genuinely to improve, patient outcomes and to, free up doctors and nurses from having to spend so much time on administrative work, if that was the objective, and AI could do that, which it could, AI could greatly assist with that, then sure, that would be beneficial to the NHS and to patients. So AI is not the problem, I would suggest. Large language model and the sort of large generative AI and data models are not the problem. It is the application of it by people with very specific agendas, such as Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, people like that.
Starmer.
So, you know, that's the problem. It's not necessarily that in questioning this stuff that you would be rejecting the technology. It's that the technology is being applied in a, detrimental fashion.
So then obviously the question is, how do you push back?
Well, I mean, this is a, you know, I wrote this piece the other day, and then I had a bit of a to and fro in the comment section. And my concern is, and I think another reason why they brought Brickcard in is because it frames the Overton window of the debate about digital ID. You know, you can, if you accept the brick card, you've accepted digital ID. If you reject the brick card, you've rejected digital ID. But the brick card is not, the brick card is not representative of what digital ID is. So just because you've rejected the brick card, that doesn't mean you rejected the digital ID system. Because as you were just saying, you know, because of the political situation, socioeconomic situation, the rollout of that is currently looking inevitable. So in order to resist that, you would have to do things like, you know, we were talking about earlier, like not have a digital ID passport. Now, I it's not entirely possible to avoid all that. So, for example, I have to have a driving license. I have to have one. That is not something that I can avoid. And there'll be millions of people in similar situations with certain digital IDs that they have to have. But if we are aware of how the system operates, we can minimise that. We could not comply with the things we don't need. We can ensure that our data is protected. But that does mean, unfortunately, non-compliance, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. Now, that inevitably means that not having the benefits and the advantages and the conveniences that will be offered to you in order to get you to adopt digital ID. So one of the things that's happened already, apparently, in the UK, is that the sales of brick phones have gone up. They've gone through the roof, because obviously
Nokia 3310.
Those kinds of phones. Yeah, good old phones.
They were great.
Yeah, they're good phones. Yeah, another thing about it, they didn't have inbuilt obsolescence, did they? They still work now if you've got one, you know. So
yes, you can drop it and you can throw it and it still works.
Yeah, yeah. But the point is, that's this kind of thing that people would have to do to resist. So get rid of their smartphones, potentially. Given younger people's evident addiction to smartphones, that's going to be difficult for them. But the only option is digital ID, accepting digital ID. So non-compliance means a little bit of inconvenience, potentially some hardship, But what it really boils down to, and something, you know, we were talking about earlier, why I like the kind of the African approach to things, is maximizing your independence. You have to be as independent and self-sufficient as possible. Now, that doesn't mean you'll be able to, everyone be able to have a small holding and live off the land. It just means that you have to think about maximizing your independence at every available opportunity. So am I going to go into a supermarket, buy goods, food from a large corporate retailer, pay with a card, and then ensure that I get my club card points stamped, like most people do, so that they get the benefits and the advantages and the ease and the function of doing that? Well, what non-compliance would mean is, no, you're not. You are going to barter, you're going to exchange, you're going to go to local food markets, you're going to buy food from high street grocers, you're going to pay in cash, you're not going to get, which means you'll have to pay a bit more probably for food. You know, so these are the decisions that we would need to take in order to actually resist, or those kinds of decisions, in order to actually resist the rollout of this digital panopticon, because it is happening everywhere, as you said.
Well, let's assume some good intentions, just for the sake of, you know, devil's advocate. A standard citizen who lives, you know, a normal life, goes to work, all that sort of thing, should be fine, right?
Well, no. No, I mean, it's fine as long as you are totally compliant. As long as you do not ever... I mean, think, for example, I mean, a good analogy is the Canadian truckers' protest. So the Canadian truckers' protest was entirely lawful. They were exercising that, and interesting, we've just seen this now in the UK, where they're putting further restrictions on protest. Now, protest is an important part, it's an important aspect of how a supposedly democratic society is supposed to function. You need a vehicle through which to express your displeasure to your public servants, which is what the government is supposed to be. So, you know, in Canada, when a group of people, or admittedly a large group of people, did an obstructive protest, it was undoubtedly obstructive, but it was a lawful protest against, and you would argue, a legitimate protest against unfair restrictions. Now, the government then worked with the private sector, banks and the payment service providers and the private sector insurance companies, to put those lawfully, you know, peaceful, law-abiding citizens out of business. Now, that is the kind of thing that in order to do that, the Canadian government had to have special executive legislation. They needed to approach the private sector companies, the banks and the insurance companies, to go along with their idea, with their plans. So that, for the government, was, you know, relatively complex. In a digital ID based and digital currency based system, there would be no need for any of that from the state. The state will simply turn off or switch off your ability to buy insurance. Your insurance will be represented as a token on a blockchain. They'll cut you off from, because they will have, because they, the system they want to introduce is a permissioned ledger system. So a permission ledger means that access to the system is granted. It's not egalitarian as a permissionless ledger would be. In a permissionless ledger, anyone can access the system. In a permission ledger, only those with the appropriate permissions can access the ledger. And of course, you can centrally control who has permission and who doesn't. And it's a so in a in that kind of situation, for ordinary law-abiding citizens who have nothing to fear or nothing to worry about, you don't know in the future what might happen that you might choose to, or you might find troublesome, that you want to protest against, or you want to stand against, or something that you don't want to do. You have no way of knowing that. Even if you've been all your life, you've been a law-abiding, good citizen, you don't know what will happen in the future that you might think, well, I don't want to participate in that, I don't want to go along with that. In a digital ID-based digital gulag, you won't have a choice, because your things like cutting you off from finances will be done by the system rather than by the state.
You keep talking about the state, but I want to throw your own fantastic work back at you and suggest that it's not just the state, it's the PPPs.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, when I say the state, I do mean a public-private partnership. I don't just mean the private sector. I mean the private and the public sector working in partnership together. That is the original model, obviously, of, you know, kind of 1930s Italian fascism. And that is what we've got. That is what we've got. In terms of it being a partnership between the private and the public sector, not in terms of it being, you know, shooting people behind bike sheds. I mean, that's...
That's what makes the whole thing so difficult, because if it's a, you know, a relationship between the state and private companies, you know, you have Facebook, which people love to say is a private company. We all know that's nonsense in so many ways. Works hand in hand with the state.
Yeah.
Well, so now, I mean, now it looks as though you really, really don't have too many options.
No, well, I mean, things like Facebook, you know, I mean, it was formerly a DARPA project called LifeLog, wasn't it? So, I mean, it's...
On the same day.
Yeah, same day. So, I mean, it's pretty clear that it's LifeLog. It's a DARPA project. Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, that's... It is very difficult to imagine life living without these things. Although, you know, I mean, I would also say to people, I mean, I remember... Because I'm old, you see. So I remember there not being any Facebook, there not being any mobile phones, there not being any... And I don't remember my life being terrible because I didn't have those things. So, you know, I mean, it's... I think
Ian,
people...
Ian, are you saying that you walked 30 kilometres in the snow barefoot and you lived inside a cardboard box?
Yeah, well, I was lucky if I got a bowl of grit in the morning.
Please, sir, can I have some more?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was very fortunate. I had a very nice childhood. I was lucky, but we didn't have that stuff, and I didn't. And as it came,
the thing is, though, I'm trying to imagine 50 years from now,
yep.
And it does seem like it's just inevitable. And I'm not being complacent, but I do wonder if we, you know, pushing back, we'll ever win.
Well, another point, going back to having the discussions with people in the chat box, I'm firmly of the view that it'll be generational. If we're serious about resisting this, I mean, the rollout of the digital infrastructure, the interoperable digital infrastructure that is going to make this system... You know, it does look inevitable. It does look inevitable. It's happening everywhere. It's happening everywhere in the world. Simultaneously. I was talking to someone from New Zealand the other day. Exactly the same kind of push for digital ID and central bank digital currency, which is one model of digital, programmable digital currency. Obviously in the US...
stable coin.
Yeah, and obviously in the US they've gone for stable coins, which is just another model of programmable digital currency. You know, so, it's happening everywhere all at the same time. because it is a global agenda, which is something that I've, you know, I mean, there's no doubt it's a global agenda. It's not possible that it would be happening everywhere around the world at the same time if it wasn't.
It's just coincidence.
Yeah, it's just coincidence.
But then it kind of horseshoes to what you said early in the conversation, that perhaps some geographical locations might be better, you know, as a sort of a buffer zone. African countries, for example, are very, very far behind, I think, a lot of this kind of rollout.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, I know a lot of people have moved to Central and South America to for that reason, you know, that it's not as advanced. You know, and certainly you could, I mean, and also, I mean, there's nothing to stop you forming communities, I suppose, anywhere you like in the world, which chooses not to adopt this stuff. But the problem is, one, you know, states want their taxes, governments and their partners want their taxes, they want the public investment, you know, so that they don't like it when you opt out of that kind of thing. But there may be places in the world where it's easier to opt out of that kind of thing. So, I mean, yeah, that's a choice. But, I mean, for me, you know, and I'm sure for millions of other, billions of other people around the world, you know, my family are here, my, you know, kids, my grandkids, you know, all this, you know, this, that's, I'm rooted in this country. And plus the fact, I quite like it here, despite everything. I quite like it here. So, you know, why would I want to be pushed out of my own country, I suppose, is a way that I might look at it, or the place where I live. What, pushed out by oppressive despots? I mean, no, I don't. I think at some point you do have to say, no, I am willing to kind of defend my little corner of things. You know, and I, if I was younger, and I, you know, but I mean, there again, I mean, if you had kids, I mean, as a new parent yourself, I mean, as you know, the thought of moving your children to an unknown and potentially unsafe place
is crazy.
You're not going to do that. You're not going to do it. So I mean, there's lots of reasons why we're not going to resist in that way.
But Ian, is this the hill to die on? I mean, is this that point in history that's going to be, you know, there's going to be a big bunny ear fold on that page, you know, in the book of history?
Yes, I think so. I digital ID is the key that unlocks the door for everything else that follows. But it's important to understand that the systems are already in place to go operational as soon as that door's opened. Digital ID enables the data from nearly everything you do, not nearly everything, everything you do, all your activity, all transactions, everywhere you go, to be linked. So for example, take facial recognition at the moment. So a facial recognition camera might pick you up, you know, walking down the street, and the police might be interested in knowing who you are. If your face has not already been added to the system, they, you know, they're not going to find you. And I'm not trying to defend criminal activity here. I'm just saying the way the system operates. And they might have to add you. In a digital ID world, Your face will be your biometric identifier. It will instantly connect to your digital ID, your EID, and that will instantly reveal everything about you. Now, you might say, well, if I was a criminal, if I was a burglar breaking into someone's house, that's a good thing, because the police would be able to find me very quickly. Sure, that's a good thing. But what if it's an insurance company that wants to know, you know, you told the insurance company that you're married, but actually the insurance company knows, because it's accessed the data, that you've got a lover somewhere else, and that you've been playing away from home, and therefore you're a higher insurance risk. That's how these things will play out in our day-to-day lives. Whether you're a law-abiding citizen or not, with nothing to hide, the data can be and will be used. It's already being used for things like assessing insurance, your viability for insurance or the premiums you're going to have to pay. I mean, we are looking at a very draconian behavioural control system that is going to control everything we do.
And that's the true social credit score.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's what social credit is all about. So social credit is just the set of rules that you apply to a system like this. So for example, you know, we've got a problem in the UK with lots of people, you know, being hounded and in some cases arrested and in some fewer cases prosecuted and in fewer still go to prison for things that they've said on social media. Now, the IMF has already suggested that if we have digital ID log on to the internet, our internet browser history should form part of our social credit history. The IMF arguing for that, I don't know, 10 years ago. So if you go online in the UK and say, you know, I think Keir Starmer should be booted out of government, or I think the government should be turned off. If you do something like that, that will be a black mark in your social credit history. Now, that won't necessarily affect you, you know, going to the doctor or something like that, but it could well affect you if you go for a job interview. You know, that you're looking at.
Yeah, and of course, and vaccine passports, for example.
Vaccine passports, another thing, yeah. I mean, Bill Gates has openly said that he wants digital ID to be linked to your vaccine status. So let's say, you know, you've got your biometric digital ID passport and you're legally entitled to fly, but when you present your document at, you know, the airport or whatever, it comes up, you haven't got your vaccines. You're not up to date with your vaccines. And it's an entry requirement, so you can't fly. You know, so these things, at the moment, none of these systems are quite joined up together. They're not joined up. And that is the point. That is the whole point. And I'm writing another piece at the moment to stress this point. That is the whole point of digital ID. It is to bring all these systems together. And that will be done on the back end of these systems, to bring them all together so that all of your data is constantly available to anybody with the permission to see it. And that could be anyone. That could be a bank, that could be an insurance broker, that could be the police, obviously. I mean, that could be school teachers, anyone that has permission, that is an approved access. So basically, it's going to be multinational corporations, isn't it? It's going to be Palantir, it's going to be Oracle, it's going to be Accenture. They're going to have access to it. And they'll buy it and sell it and trade it and use it as they wish. So that is the problem that we are facing, that we... And is that the hill to die on? Yeah, I think it is, actually.
Despite the dark nature of this conversation, you have pointed out that British people have rejected similar things like this post-World War I, post-World War II, 2010, I think. There is, I guess, a glimmer of hope.
I personally, I don't think the Brit card will ever come to fruition. It's not going to happen. The opposition to it is overwhelming. I mean, outside of the Parliamentary Labour Party and Tony Blair and Larry Ellison, nobody, as far as I can see, nobody wants it. I mean, when I you know, mentioned it, there's obviously the petition, which I think is a bit dubious.
Even Boris Johnson, even he said, nah.
Well, it's not only that. I mean, then you've got the in the UK, you've got the executive officer of Palantir UK, Lewis Mosley, you know, has come out and said that Palantir oppose it. Palantir opposes the Brit card. Right. Now, the reason Palantir opposes the Brit card is because Palantir is instrumental and heavily involved in setting up the interoperable system, which is called the UK Digital Attributes Trust Framework. So Palantir is deeply involved in that project. At it was a committee for, I think it was the Committee of the Digital Media, Culture and Sport Committee, Lewis Mosley said interoperability is our bread and butter, talking about Palantir. So the Brit card, it's not it doesn't exist, that's the first point. But the concept of the Brit card is superfluous to everything they do that they're doing. It doesn't fit with it. So and it doesn't fit with anything that the government has done up to this date. It's a totally anomalous, weird concept, which makes me think that it's not designed to be introduced. It's just designed to frame the conversation about digital ID in the UK.
It's what you said. It's the Overton window.
Yeah, it's just designed to frame the conversation about it so that people think that in rejecting the Brit card, they will have successfully defeated digital ID. Meanwhile, this digital ID infrastructure, this interoperable digital ID infrastructure, will be surrounding them. And they will actually be issued a digital ID, but they just won't know it because they'll just think, oh, it's just my driving license or it's just my bank card.
But it's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing with CBDCs. In the States, they go, Trump. Yeah. Trump has rejected CBDC. Meanwhile.
Yeah, no, it's exactly the same. Yeah, stable coins. I mean, in lots of respects, stable coins are worse. I mean, at least the federal, the government, certainly Congress, has some control over the Fed, theoretically. On paper, let's put it this way. On paper, it has some control over the Fed. It doesn't in any practical sense, but I mean, it could have. And if the Fed issue a central bank digital currency, that will give Congress theoretical control of that. And, you know, supposedly Congress represents the people. If Palantir issue a PYUSD stablecoin, government's got no control over that at all. I mean, and also the Genius Act, which is supposedly setting the framework for the stablecoins in the US, deliberately calls them not money. So the only legislation where they are in the US where they are subject to government oversight is for the banking standards legislation. In terms of and things which sets up things like know your customer for onboarding and regulations like that. So they have to apply by all the digital ID requirements that would enable you to onboard to get one of these coins, stable coins. Oh yeah, you've got to disclose all your information. But because it's not part of the things like the securities, it's not a security, so it's not subject to oversight by the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's not subject to information, oversight by other government departments. Groups like Palantir and Tether, and they've got far more freedom to issue these dollar-backed stable coins. And the ironic thing is, they are dollar-backed. The objective is to back them one-to-one with the US dollar. They're called payment stable coins. So they are, in every respect, apart from the legal sense, the US dollar. You know, and I think that's why we're seeing people like the EU, we've seen recently Christine Lagarde rushing to get the euro out, and the EU rushing to get, to oppose the widespread use of these dollar-backed stable coins. Because if people can trade globally in the dollar using stable coins at the press of a button, why do they need the euro? Why do they need the pound? Why do they need any other currency? So it's certainly a clever attack on the kind of global monetary system. And it could undermine CBDC. I mean, we've already seen Augustin Carstens express his anger about stable coins because, it could potentially threaten that system. But again, that having said that, although Carsten said that, the BIS itself has already set up a system for what it calls a global stable coin, a global stable coin system. So it's already prepared for that eventuality as well.
I think it was Catherine Orson-Fitz who said that the way to push back basically is one person at a time.
Yeah, no.
Which is tedious and slow, but that's probably it.
Well, I mean, I think the important thing, and definitely I would agree with Catherine about that, is the important thing is to understand that resistance is your responsibility, you and you alone. I mean, one of the other reasons I think that the brick card has been brought out, or the issue of the brick card has been promoted in the UK, is because it means that people perceive resistance as being a political effort. You know, resistance is through the ballot box. Resistance is through, putting political pressure on the government. That's how you resist. Well, of course, that's how the system wants you to resist. It wants you to resist on its own terms. It wants you to resist by putting all your time and effort into supporting the next political leader. It that's what it wants. That's the whole system is designed to funnel you towards that path of resistance, because for it is the path of least resistance. So, you know, if we are going to resist it, it means making personal choices, maximizing your independence, foregoing convenience, and probably learning to endure a bit of hardship that you weren't expecting to endure.
And maybe not use Starlink.
That becomes increasingly difficult as well. You and I are talking to each other on the internet. So we're using a US intelligence agency, DARPA developed system, you know, being transmitted around the world over interlinked satellite networks, Starlink included. You know, so we're using the B system to do what we do. So you can't completely shut yourself off from the system. I fully appreciate that. If you have to take your kids to school they insist that you have digital ID to take your kids to school, then you've got a very hard choice to make.
It's tricky. I had a friend who had a child and he said, look, our kid is not going to get an ID number. We're not going to register him on the system. And it's a very noble idea, but I don't think that kid is going to have an easy life.
Yeah, no, I mean, it depends, doesn't it? If you choose to do something like that, then you have to commit your life to giving your child the best possible opportunities and education, and you have to homeschool them and all of that kind of stuff, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It could be a very good thing.
Yeah, but I mean, they can't drive or anything. They can't open a bank account.
Yeah. No, I mean, that makes things very difficult, you know. But going back to the technology discussion that we were having earlier, I mean, one of the reasons why, undoubtedly why they've seized control of financial technology and decentralized, especially DeFi, decentralized finance, is that DeFi threatens to overturn the entire banking and financial and monetary system. Because we won't need it. So that, you know, the opportunities for us to use technology for our benefit, absent any kind of third party oversight, using the technology that is currently available, is there. We could. You know, but when you even got people like Vitaly I can't remember the guy's name, but the guy that started the Ethereum blockchain. I mean, the Ethereum ledger. I mean, he started with the most, you know, amazing ideas for the emancipation of humanity using the DeFi that he was envisaged and was capable of building and constructing. But I mean, that's just been taken over completely by the corporate the corporate public private partnership that spreads around the world.
I'm just looking at the time. Ian, so this whole conversation was largely centered around a few of your Substack articles, which I highly recommend others read. How can they find those articles and, of course, the rest of your work?
Yeah, go to Ian Davis, and my name's I-A-I-N, Davis, all one word, .com, which is my website, or go to iandavis.substack.com, which is my Substack, or read my work at Unlimited Hangout, or also Geopolitics and Empire, but also at the outlets like The Off Guardian. And also, I'm delighted to say that I've got a new book coming out. That's called The Technocratic Dark State, and that's going to be published by Unlimited Hangout's new publishing company. So it's all that'll be coming out soon. I don't quite know when, but I think it will be in the next month or so. So, so there's quite a bit of stuff out there already, and quite a bit more coming soon.
I-A-I-N. That's how I remember your website, because you have such weird spelling. I-A-I-N.
Yeah. Well, that's quite normal. That's not that weird in the UK, and that's quite common. Oh. 'Cause that's the kind of gap.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that's the Gaelic.
Ian would be I-A-N. I-A-N. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Where's that invisible, or that extra I coming from?
Oh, well, it's English, yeah, isn't it? We've got all sorts of weird, weird spelling things. I've never really...
Yes. Go on.
No, I'm just saying, I've never really done a lot. I mean, as far as I'm aware, I haven't got any kind of Scottish or Irish or anything history. But as I understand it, that's where it comes from.
English is a weird language. Have you seen that Michael McIntyre sketch where he talks about the hidden letters in words, and they don't make any sense?
Yeah, and there's that quite funny stuff going about on Twitter, isn't it, about those two guys that are trying to go through the spelling class or learning English yes, language, which is quite funny, yeah, because all the same letters sounding completely different. It's a weird language.
Anyway. Ian Davis, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It's been my pleasure, Jim. Thanks very much for inviting me.